Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, January 27th, 2022. Marfa School Board approves proposal for new high school track, discusses COVID spread. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa, a unanimous vote to approve the proposal for a brand new six-lane high school track was met with celebratory whoops and claps at Monday night's first school board meeting of 2022. All board members were present for the momentous occasion, with the exception of Board President Katie Price Folks and Sean Brugette. The school board greenlit the project to replace the existing track, which is experiencing structural failures, for a total of $926,000. The company installing the new track, Hellas, is set to begin construction in the coming weeks. If all goes according to plan, the project will be completed in time for graduation in late May. By graduation day, we'd have green grass, a new track, and looking really, really nice for our seniors that are walking, said Superintendent Oscar Aguero. The school board plans to seek out donations to help offset the cost of the new track, but will likely pull the majority from fund balance, leftover revenue, either from state funding or property taxes, that a school district keeps in reserves. The board will also need to budget for the track's maintenance, which is a recommended $5,000 to $12,000 cost yearly or every other year for track cleaning, and $245,000 to retop every 10 to 12 years. While deciding whether or not to approve the new track, Board Vice President Krista Marquez raised concerns about the school's declining enrollment and whether or not the board would be able to afford the track's upkeep in the future, with other big-ticket items like a new heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, HVAC system, and security improvements also on the horizon. This is something that we are going to have to make sure it doesn't affect our balances when we get there. We don't want to be like, in 10 years, let's figure it out, said Marquez. Maybe there's some sort of plan. We'll save a little each year, and it will get allocated. Ernie Villarreal reminded the board that their recent audit results showed the school board was in good standing financially, and Aguero said even with the construction of the new track, there would be a remaining $2 million in the fund balance reserve. He added, in the past 7 years, since he has been at Marfa ISD, they have never dipped into the fund balance. Athletic Director Linda Ojeda chimed in, stating the new track has been discussed as a possibility for the past 8 years, but no action has been taken, and prices only go up every year. Board Member Renee Gonzalez echoed Ojeda's concerns about the rising cost and said a new track would help boost the community by providing a visible upgrade to the school's campus. I'm a strong believer in look good, feel good, play good. The biggest thing the community is going to see is something on the exterior, something on the outside. HVAC is good and everything, but you can't see it, said Gonzalez. This school hasn't had something for people to go by and say, wow, they're doing something. It's time to take action. Ultimately, all present agreed and passed the proposal for the new track unanimously, giving Aguero permission to sign the contract with Hellas and lock in pricing. Next up was an update from English as a Second Language ESL coordinator Bernadette Devine, who overall reported a lack of consistency in language learning due to COVID school closures. She said the majority of elementary students have advanced to either Tier 1 or 2 status, the desired benchmark, with 25%, or 4 out of 16 students, lingering on the Tier 3 level. Marfa ISD's ESL population is less than 20%, said Aguero. There are 42 high school students enrolled in the program and 28 program graduates who are still monitored. One priority that was highlighted during the ESL discussion was the enhancement of the students' speaking abilities, in particular for elementary and high school level learners. Board member Yolanda Jurado said it might be worth observing ESL aides in classrooms and making sure they're encouraging students to speak, not simply translating for them, which can be a common problem. I just want to make sure they are empowered to speak for themselves, however that may be, said Jurado. The superintendent then gave a COVID update, citing 22 active positive cases in students, 5 positive cases in staff members, and others out due to exposure. In total, 42 students and 8 staff members were being quarantined due to either sickness or exposure at the time of the meeting. Aguero reported the district was at a 92% attendance rate for the year, despite COVID-related absences. Aguero said teachers and administrators were doing their best to fill in and pivot when needed. The elementary school was stable, he said, with one substitute helping. At the high school, some classes have been combined, with teachers instructing via Skype or assisting other classes during their planning periods. The high school is utilizing Google Chromebooks and the Google Classroom platform to distribute and review assignments to students in quarantine, he said. The district is working to abide by Texas Education Agency requirements, which do not allow for a teacher to teach in person and video conference simultaneously. Aguero said the accountability at this point is on the students to complete their provided assignments. Letters are soon being sent out to parents and guardians in English and Spanish about the school's updated 2021-2022 academic calendar, announced last week. New full instruction days are February 9th, February 21st, April 13th, and April 18th. The district has a remaining 5 days they can use as bad weather days that do not need to be made up, said Aguero. Depending on how the spread of COVID continues to move throughout the school and community, the school may choose to abbreviate spring break, said Aguero. After rock art damage, Big Bend attempts to prevent vandalism amid tourism growth. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Big Bend National Park. News of irreparable damage to ancient rock art at one of Big Bend National Park's historic archaeological sites spread nationwide in early January after the park put out a call for help, tracking down the responsible parties. Though the culprits remain at large, authorities have taken action to try and prevent future incidents at a time when vandalism in the park has risen along with an increase in visitors. At the site known as Indian Head, located in the northwest corner of the park near Terlingua, vandals scratched their names and the date directly over rock art, which is estimated to be around 3,000 to 8,000 years old. Tom Vandenberg, chief of interpretation and visitor services at the national park, said while graffiti in the area dates back to 1902, this particular occurrence was alarming. It was kind of a kick in the gut for those of us that commit our careers to protect places like that. So we decided to put that press release out to ask for help and to raise awareness of the sensitivity of these sites, said Vandenberg. The Indian Head area has become increasingly popular in recent years, said Vandenberg. While not being included on the park's maps, brochures, or website, social media posts from visitors have created a draw. As a result, visitation to the site has gone up over the last 2 years, averaging around 4,000 visitors a year, according to data collected by the park. Meanwhile, incidents of vandalism in the park have doubled in recent history, averaging around 80 per year the past couple of years, compared to 40 a year from 2015 to 2017, said Vandenberg, who attributed the increase to a spike in visitors. The park's recently determined annual 2021 attendance numbers were up 25% from the previous year, and the park has seen nearly a 50% increase in visitors since 2016, with many of those people first-timers to public lands. "There's a little bit of a learning curve there," said Vandenberg. "These are protected places. It's just not a place to come and write your name on rocks and damage things." Vandenberg said while the park's staff has not increased in conjunction with more visitors, they have recently filled some long unfilled positions and are fully staffed. Of a 3-person archaeological team, 2 positions are currently open at the park. Mitigation measures have been put in place since the incident occurred, including the reinstallation of cameras which have been used on and off throughout the years, said Vandenberg. The park hosts guided tours of the area, but it is not a requirement to be accompanied by a park staff person to visit the site. While the Indian Head site is within the park's boundaries, it is reached by going through private land, not by going through the park. "We patrol it fairly regularly, probably as much as any other place in the park because it is sensitive. But it has its own unique challenges because it's accessed from outside the entrance of the park," said Vandenberg. In addition to continuing routine patrols, park staff aim to provide additional signage and establish an informational kiosk to further educate visitors on the sensitivity and protected status of the archaeological area. And then there is the increased surveillance that comes in the age of internet virality and online sleuthing. According to Vandenberg, the Instagram post announcing the incident garnered more attention than any other post in the park's history, receiving over 9,000 likes and 1,300-plus comments. The story drew the attention of the national media and was covered by outlets including Texas Monthly, the New York Times, and even the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC Radio. "We had tremendous interest in it, which was kind of surprising to all of us, honestly, and a little scary at the same time, because we don't really want to direct a lot of attention at this one specific site," said Vandenberg. "But with something so egregious as that, it's like, well, help us out if you know anything. Please let us know." The flood of interest from the public resulted in over 50 tips from concerned citizen detectives trying to assist in identifying the vandals. Clear clues in the form of 4 names, Adrian, Ariel, Isaac, and Norma, and the date, 12/26/21, scratched on the rock, informed the search. "This whole thing sort of became crowdsourced," said Vandenberg. "There's people scrolling through social media, trying to find connections from these photos to those photos, and anybody that posted things from Big Bend during that time." All credible tips are passed on to the park's law enforcement rangers, who have been following up on every one, said Vandenberg. Investigations are ongoing, and as of press time, there were no major developments in the case. Because it occurred on federal property, the crime is considered a violation of the Code of Federal Regulations. The vandals could face up to a $5,000 fine or 6 months in prison. Such areas are also protected by the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, which could raise the case to a higher level of penalties, said Vandenberg. In the meantime, experts have done their best to undo the vandals' damage, but there was only so much to be done. The day after the park received initial news of the vandalism at Indian Rock, Lynn Pruitt, archaeology technician, along with retired park archaeologist Tom Alex, went out to survey the site and found it looked worse than expected. It was later determined some well-meaning visitors attempted to clean off the newly carved names, but in doing so only damaged the site further. Tap water, which can contain trace amounts of chlorine, had been poured over the rock, staining its patina. Pruitt and Alex spent a couple days rehabbing the surface of the rock, using benign methods of distilled water, artists' brushes, and absorbent pads to blot the surface. The rock's appearance was greatly improved after treatments, said Vandenberg, but the names, which appear to have been carved using a sharp rock, will forever remain. The affected rock art is classified as part of the Pecht abstract tradition, a complex asymmetrical style composed of geometric forms and grid-like lines, considered to be archaic in age, dating back as far as 8,500 years, and found throughout the American Southwest. Desert abstract and geometric figures, like the ones found at Indian Head, are considered to be some of the oldest imagery in North America, said Alex. The Indian Head site is home to many petroglyphs produced over a span of time based on the varying degrees of weatherization, said Alex. The imagery represents a time where people were holistically integrated with nature, he said, but much of its underlying meaning remains a mystery to us today. Unlike more recent representational petroglyphs of animals and human life. It's only in the more recent time period that representational art was produced. That older archaic stuff is all abstract. So consequently, the meaning of it, we don't know, said Alex. Whatever was in their mental template of how they viewed and how they depicted things is all in their minds. Without knowledge and culture, there's no way we can touch that. These archaeological resources are important to preserve so future developments in the field can be made, said Alex. Natural pigments may also be used to conserve rocks, but in this case, because the scrawls were directly on top of the rock art, that treatment method is not an option, said Vandenberg. The exact number of archaeological sites within Big Bend National Park is unknown, but there are at least 3,000. Oscar Rodriguez, a West Texas native and enrolled member of the Lipan Apache tribe, actively fighting to preserve the area's historic burial sites, echoed Vandenberg, noting the uptick in vandalism could be due to so many newcomers in the region. Rodriguez, by contrast, says he can trace his roots to the Big Bend region well before the 1700s. The history of the region has been passed down in his family for generations. These conversations about these sites might be a surprise to some folks, said Rodriguez. Not to me. I grew up in that. Those were the conversations I had with my parents and grandparents and people from previous generations. To us, we've been there a long time. We know it. He said acts of vandalism to archaeological sites are taken personally by people indigenous to the area. If an archaeological dig discovers human remains, for example, his community will experience that on a different level than more objective researchers, said Rodriguez. To those of us who have deep roots in West Texas, we see them as disinterring ancestors as opposed to, you know, these archaic people who existed long before human settlement took place in West Texas, and these people are not related to us, said Rodriguez. He said his ancestors were among a population which migrated to and from north central Mexico to the Great Plains before settling in Presidio and El Mulato, meaning many sites along those routes were created and revisited, helping demonstrate the specific use of some of the locations. Growing up, he knew of certain ranches in West Texas where people paid an entry fee to collect artifacts such as arrowheads. Rodriguez emphasized further education for younger generations and consequences for when vandalism does occur going forward. I think it will be important to catch them and to prosecute them to whatever extent the law allows, said Rodriguez, just so that it becomes part of the public consciousness that there are consequences to doing this. A retired park archaeologist and resident of the Terlingua area, Alex said off-road traffic in the area has recently increased, and the site has a long history of attracting curious transients dating back to the early 1900s. Tourists are coming in. They're just very disrespectful. They either don't know, don't care, or maybe both, about private property and scenery and respecting staying on the road, said Alex. One of the issues about Indian Head is that one of the old original roads through this country went right past the site. So people were able to drive there and camp out. I'm sure that people hunted arrowheads and God knows what else they did to the area. Alex said attempts to restrict access to archaeological sensitive areas using barriers and gates are often futile. Closing it off, fencing it off, that kind of thing, only keeps honest people honest. It doesn't stop the people who want to go in and do any kind of damage, said Alex. Disrespectful people are going to do what they want to do regardless. Photo by Cody Bjornson for the Big Bend Sentinel. John Ludecky, Mono Prieto resident, surveys a map of proposed transmission line routes at an open house hosted last week by American Electric Power, AEP. AEP meets with locals over a proposed transmission line project by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa, Fort Davis. Community members last week gathered at two open house events to submit feedback and share concerns regarding a proposed transmission line improvement project, which would see American Electric Power, AEP, install larger infrastructure early next year. The project's scope would involve replacing an existing nearly century-old power line that begins at the Alamito Creek substation in Marfa's Sal Cepuedes neighborhood, runs north adjacent to Texas State Highway 17, and ends at Fort Davis substation. The line was selected for the upgrade by AEP due to its age and the fact that it is the singular power supply for Fort Davis. Last week's open house events, one in Fort Davis and one in Marfa, were put on in order for AEP to share information with affected landowners and garner feedback about the proposed routes amidst local concerns over increased infrastructure and view sheds. The citizens of Fort Davis have to have a power line, so it needs to go somewhere, said Blake Burchard, external affairs manager at AEP. It's all an information gathering. A handful of residents from Fort Davis and Marfa showed up to both meetings, with others only attending one night. Mono Prieto residents, a small neighborhood of around 13 ranches between Marfa and Fort Davis, were well represented. Judge Mary Ann Ludecky, Justice of the Peace for Jeff Davis County and Mono Prieto resident, said she knows the new transmission lines are inevitable, but would like to see the lines buried out of a concern for the region's environmental features, like the dark skies and pristine views. I don't want to see it, said Ludecky. I don't want to put up with the people going through the maintenance on the lines and the destruction of private property. Bury it and be done with it, because we have to live here from now on. Ludecky wasn't the only concerned citizen to bring up the idea of burying the line, but AEP said it would be far too costly and wasn't feasible given the level of voltage. Under the plan, existing wooden poles would be replaced with larger, taller, 75 to 85 feet tall weathered steel poles, which would occur every 600 feet and create a 100-foot right-of-way on either side of each pole, meaning AEP will hold property easements to access the poles for repairs. The poles will be built to 138 kilovolt, K kV capacity, but will continue to operate at 69 kV. The Fort Davis substation is currently a 69 kV station, but could be converted to a 138 kV station, like the one in South Cipuetas in the future if needed, said Burchard. Costs for these infrastructure projects are reflected in the prices customers pay for electricity, said Burchard. So electricity rates will likely go up for local AEP customers. That is one of the reasons AEP tries not to overspend on the improvements, he said. The timeline outlined early 2022 to early 2023 for the Public Utilities Commission, PUC, application and approval process, with construction beginning spring 2023 and concluding early 2024. After collecting public feedback on the proposed routes, AEP has the opportunity to revise the current route map before submitting their project application to the PUC, who will ultimately determine the final path of the power lines. Some South Cipuetas residents expressed the desire for one more public meeting in order to see how maps change after their feedback is incorporated, but that is not the typical process AEP follows. South Cipuetas, a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood, was primarily represented by a few white residents, a problem the community was aware of after an earlier virtual meeting with AEP this fall resulted in a similar turnout. The Big Bend Sentinel previously reported on some South Cipuetas residents' reactions to the news of the forthcoming transmission line project. Many residents were leery of the supposed improvements to their already infrastructure-crowded neighborhood. In providing their feedback about the new route, many mentioned the desire to help remove rather than add additional poles, which is an option on the table. In order to get the word out about the project, AEP is required to reach out to landowners within 300 feet of the affected area. Some South Cipuetas residents took issue with that policy at last week's meeting, emphasizing the need for input from renters and the neighborhood as a whole, rather than just the directly adjacent properties. South Cipuetas resident Annette Mendoza said she tried to get the word out in the neighborhood about the open house by distributing flyers to around 50 homes. She will now work on passing out AEP's feedback questionnaires from the open house, but it can be challenging to reach people, she said. We have some vacant homes because the homes were owned generations ago and now relatives just visit and share the property, Mendoza said. Despite a low turnout among the neighborhood's Hispanic residents at the open houses, other South Cipuetas community members and Mendoza will try to capture their feedback and concerns about the project to relate to AEP, though there are concerns elderly residents without internet access will be difficult to reach. It's a good thing the questionnaire is a hard copy, but then who's going to pay the postage? It starts getting to feel heavy and almost like we're defeated before we begin, Mendoza said. Construction engineering company Burns and McDonnell generated the proposed routes using a combination of aerial photography and site visits. They will analyze the public's comments and make recommendations, but it is ultimately up to AEP to decide whether or not to add or subtract routes. Utility companies generally avoid what they call habitable structures, said Burns and McDonald representative Derek Green, but in South Cipuetas' case, that is impossible because the substation is located within the neighborhood. The Alamito Creek substation has been in the South Cipuetas neighborhood for several decades. Randy Roper, regulatory case manager with AEP, explained the land the substation sits on was originally sold to AEP by Presidio County, although county tax records do not indicate an exact year. The substation was constructed as a 69 kilovolt and 138 kilovolt facility in 1980 and expanded in 2010 when an existing line going to Presidio was also upgraded. Residents were given the opportunity to comment on the 2010 expansion, which was when the first steel poles went in, according to AEP. Many Salsipuedas residents remembered the look of the neighborhood changing significantly after the 2010 substation upgrades. There are a total of 5 power lines going into and out of the Alamito Creek substation in Salsipuedas. They extend to Alpine, Presidio, Fort Davis, and to another substation in Marfa, with the final one extending to the Berea Junction substation between Balmoray and Fort Stockton. The Salsipuedas neighborhood, an area east of Marfa, is technically outside of the city limits and considered an extraterritorial jurisdiction, ETJ. Salsipuedas residents do not pay city property taxes, therefore pay an increased rate for city utilities. There are no local zoning laws that apply to the community, although there are state laws that apply to unincorporated areas. On the night of the first open house, Salsipuedas residents asked whether the line could extend east from the substation before heading north to Fort Davis, a direction with the fewest homes. AEP and their contractors ultimately concluded it was possible, but there were serious complications. Since the east route was not on the original potential route map, it may or may not be included in AEP's application to the PUC. When AEP submits their application to the PUC, which they hope to do soon, landowners will be notified by mail. At that point, landowners who oppose or want to advocate for a specific route may do so by becoming a project intervener and must do so within 45 days of the notice. Becoming an intervener can involve traveling to Austin for hearings and legal costs if lawyers need to be hired, but it is also possible to go straight to the PUC, said Roy Bermay, an AEP regulatory consultant. Shelley Bernstein of the Big Bend Conservation Alliance said the organization and Salsipuedas residents will work with County Judge Cinderella Guevara and Senator Cesar Blanco's office to advocate that the public hearing with the PUC be a virtual meeting, as opposed to in person in Austin. Rainer Judd, a Salsipuedas property owner, said the transmission line improvement project highlights a regional need for more long-term, comprehensive infrastructure planning in the Tri-County area. She said it will be important for the communities to unify going forward. It seems Fort Davis, Marfa, Presidio, and Alpine should all share infrastructure fairly. Right now, Marfa, and therefore Salsipuedas, is carrying an enormous amount of infrastructure, said Judd. What if the Tri-County area got together and worked to do a strategic plan for ecotourism and cultural tourism? What would planning like that look like, and how would it help us to engage with other people who come in? Voter registration events coming to the Tri-County area. Tri-County. There's still time to register to vote ahead of the March primaries, where voters will cast their ballots to determine what candidates will appear in the November general election. In addition to selecting candidates to represent their parties in local county elections, voters will select district-based congressional and legislative offices, the State Board of Education, and judicial seats. Candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, land commissioner, agriculture commissioner, comptroller, and one of 3 seats on the railroad commission will also be on the ballot. The Tri-County Voter Promoters, a nonpartisan organization serving Brewster, Jeff Davis, and Presidio counties, will host the following voter registration events. Thursday, January 27th, Marfa Post Office, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday, January 28th, Porter's in Alpine, across from True Value, noon to 3 p.m. Friday, January 28th, Fort Davis Post Office, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, January 29th, Chili Pepper in Study Butte, noon to 3 p.m. Monday, January 31st, Alpine Post Office, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Early voting for the March 1st primaries will take place from February 14th to 25th. The deadline to apply to vote by mail is February 18th. To register to vote, check your registration status, request an absentee ballot, or locate a polling place. Visit vote.org. Individuals may also register to vote at the County Tax Assessor, Collector, or Election Administrator's Office. For Brewster County, contact Elections Administrator Laura Nussbaum at 432-837-6230. For Jeff Davis County, contact Tax Assessor, Collector, Sheriff William Kitts at 432-837-6230. And for Presidio County, contact Tax Assessor Collector Natalia Williams at 432-729-4081. In Presidio, individuals may register to vote at the County Courthouse Annex Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. and 1 to 4 p.m., or at the Presidio Public Library, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and 3 to 6 p.m. Presidio drivers renewing or applying for a license may also choose to register to vote when they submit their materials at the local driver's license office. In Presidio County, early voting will take place February 14th to 25th at the Marfa Visitor Center, USO Building, and Presidio County Annex Building C.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, January 27th, 2022. Local Data Center Trend Continues by Megan Waring. Some places have Amazon or Google warehouses to bring an economic boost. As for Pecos County, the trend of data centers will continue to diversify the job market, with a third facility planned to be completed by the end of this year. The Pecos County Commissioner's Court established the Stargazer Reinvestment Zone and executed a Chapter 381 Economic Development Agreement with Blockstream Services for a data center on Monday, January 24th. The approximate 15-acre tract of land is located off Highway 190. The agreement is only for the initial phase, EDC Director Remy Ramos explained. Blockstream will come back to the court with a second phase with the design and costs associated with it. A payment in lieu of taxes is expected by the developer in the amount of $144,753.40 beginning in 2024. And in 2023, the payment will be $217,130.10. Also included in the agreement, the developer will make a capital investment no less than $100 million toward the project. We are excited to be investing in this area, said Brad Peterson, a representative of Blockstream. We are excited about the jobs it's going to bring. I'm already starting to work with local contractors in the area on helping do the designs of the project, as well as the construction and build. The data center will bring in a minimum of 20 full-time equivalent positions. Judge Joe Schuster was concerned that the agreement did not include a requirement that the data center employees needed to reside in Pecos County. I understand that in the beginning they may have some people they are going to hire come in here initially to get this phase started. But we look at the 20-year-long range. We want these employees and people living in Pecos County. We need the jobs and we need the population. That's the most important thing. Schuster added that he doesn't want to see more people commuting from other facilities to work at a job in Pecos County. I'm tired of Pecos County providing all of those jobs and they're going to Midland or Odessa to live. I want them to live in Pecos County. I don't care if it's Iran, Sheffield, Fort Stockton, Cuyahoga, or Imperial, as long as they live in Pecos County. Ramos assured the court that the agreement can be amended to reflect the residency requirement, while also expressing the need for additional housing on the east side of the county. When you're getting 20 people to come in and do this, IRM does not have 20 houses for sale right now, Ramos explained. This being so far on the east end of the county, I understand the concern that we don't want them to run to another county, but there is no availability for 20 houses. Plus, can you get 20 people to move to IRM? Commissioner Mickey Jack Perry said that as these data centers and other projects continue to invest in the area, the county is going to be compelled to really consider what can be done to address housing issues. The project will be completed by December 31, 2022. Commissioners and Ramos are set to convene in a workshop on Tuesday, February 1 at 10 a.m. to further discuss the agreement. The Pecos County Commissioners Court also unanimously approved the revised Pecos County Hospital 2022 salary schedule to reflect a pay increase of $3 an hour for all staff. The hospital's previous recommendation, which was approved by the board in December and then by the commissioners in early January, only targeted some positions, but the county requested PCMH to see how all staff could be included, allowing the hospital to move $515,000 of budgeted agency staffing funds to employee salaries. The positions that were already bumped up by $3 an hour in the original competitive wage adjustment will stay the same. They will not receive an additional $3 an hour. Cases Show Downward Trend by Nathan Heuer. Pecos County reached an all-time high of 341 COVID active cases on January 12th, as reported by the county's Emergency Management Coordinator, Jesse Dominguez. That number has since dropped to 205 as of January 24th. Four people were reported to be hospitalized at Pecos County Hospital on January 24th, and four additional Pecos County residents were hospitalized at various health care facilities outside the county. Since the Omicron variant began to show signs of spiking locally on December 23rd, there have been four additional COVID-related deaths that have occurred in the past 5 weeks. In that same time span, there have been 771 new cases reported, which would put the death rate at approximately 1 out of 200. The recently passed vaccine mandate for healthcare facilities that provide Medicare and Medicaid coverage will have little or no effect on Pecos County Hospital next month. Betsy Rubisco, CEO, said on January 25th that healthcare workers at their facility will have until February 21st to get their first COVID shot vaccine of their choosing and the second one by March 21st. The CEO stated that only one employee at the hospital has not been vaccinated, and that individual will be getting their shot before next month's deadline. Pecos County residents who have received their booster shot grew to over 3,000 in the last 2 weeks. The growth puts the percent of vaccine-eligible residents who have received a booster in the county to 21.5%. The number of people who have received a vaccine for the first time or their second shot have seen a minimal increase in the past 2 weeks. A total of 78 people became fully vaccinated, while an additional 143 residents received their first shot. Local man charged with intoxication manslaughter by Nathan Heuer. A Fort Stockton man is being charged with intoxication manslaughter after a two-car crash that killed two people on January 22nd. Fort Stockton resident Enriquez, 39, was traveling west on FM 3472 in a Dodge Charger just outside of Odessa city limits when he entered the eastbound lanes and collided head-on with another Dodge Charger at 11:50 p.m. Fort Stockton resident Jeannie Marie, 40, who was a passenger riding with Enriquez, was transported to Medical Center Hospital before being pronounced dead. The driver of the vehicle, heading eastbound, Mia Jocelyn, of Odessa, was pronounced dead at the scene. Enriquez is currently in serious condition as of Monday, according to the DPS. DPS reported on Monday afternoon that the preliminary investigation revealed evidence of intoxication of the driver. As a result of the preliminary evidence, the driver has been charged with intoxication manslaughter. EDC discusses potential job fair in Fort Stockton by Megan Waring. Job seekers could expect to see a community job fair coming to Fort Stockton, but there are no concrete plans yet. The Bureau of Labor Statistics recently reported that 4.5 million American workers quit their jobs in November 2021, which is a trend of numbers that is becoming known as the Great Resignation. Like many areas, Fort Stockton businesses are experiencing their own employee recruitment and retention struggles. The Fort Stockton Economic Development Corporation started the conversation regarding a community-wide job fair on Thursday, January 20th, at their regular meeting, but no action was taken. It seems like business is picking up, even with COVID at full blast, the city councilman Reuben Falcon said. I'm seeing work crews. There are guys that I haven't seen in 2 years. There are no employees. I'm minus two right now, and a mom and pop like us, an untrained cook, is $15 an hour, and there's nobody to work. We have a problem. EDC Director Remy Ramos said the city should wait to see what kind of turnout the Cormant Data System job fair receives before planning one for the entire town, because he is concerned that there might not be sufficient interest. Berks did theirs, and they had a really good turnout, Ramos said. They were able to process about 50 people through our office. If Cormant has a good turnout, we can consider trying to put something together in one of the community buildings.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, January 20th. Landgraft fact-finding at Crane County well blowout. The story was written by Smokey Briggs. State Representative Brooks Landgraf of District 81 visited the site of a well blowout in Crane County Friday afternoon. The well is located about one-fourth of a mile south of State Highway 329, a few miles east of the Ward County line. The long-forgotten well began spewing a 200-foot geyser of brine water into the air around January 2nd, and as of Friday, January 14th, was still flowing at an estimated 20 barrels per minute. Last week, after organizing efforts to cap the well for nearly 2 weeks, the Texas Railroad Commission identified the old well as the Gulf Oil Corporation W.N. Waddell et al. Test Well Number 112. According to the Railroad Commission, the well is the responsibility of Chevron, and after being notified by the Railroad Commission, Chevron took over operations at the site on Friday, January 14th. At the time of Landgraf's visit at around 2 p.m., the well was still flowing, although the geyser was shorter than previously observed, reportedly because a restriction at the wellhead had either blown out or had been removed, creating a less constricted escape for the under-pressure brine and hence a shorter plume. Present at the impromptu meeting outside the gate nearest the well on State Highway 329 were Landgraf, David Ramirez, Border and Permian Basin Area Director for the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, Ashley Watt, owner of the nearby Antina Ranch, Sarah Stogner, legal counsel for Antina Ranch and currently a candidate for Railroad Commission Commissioner in the upcoming Republican primary, Raymond Straub, a professional geoscientist employed by Antina Ranch, along with several members of his staff, as well as Crane County Sheriff Andrew Aguilar and his chief deputy, Chris Villegas. At the outset of the meeting, Watt stated her concern was that the blowout, and more specifically the hydrology underlying the blowout, was a danger to freshwater aquifers that were pierced by the 1,390-foot well and many others like it in the region and across the state, a concern she had hired Straub Corporation to investigate on the Antina. The Waddell Well is located about 2 miles south of the Antina's southernmost fence line and 4 to 6 miles south of the area where Watt says she has had several similar blowouts from old wells on her ranch. The well was originally drilled in 1948, according to Railroad Commission records. Stogner emphasized to Landgraf and Ramirez that the worry was not so much the brine flowing to the surface, which was bad enough, but the possibility of subterranean blowouts that could push the brine into drinking water aquifers. Quote, "In a way, we are lucky when these blowouts breach the surface so we can see them. What about the ones that break out of the casing directly into aquifers but look completely benign at the surface? The aquifers in this part of the world almost universally have been getting saltier over time to varying degrees. Something horrifically bad is going on with the aquifers underneath this part of the Permian," Watt said during a later interview. Landgraf told the group that he appreciated the chance to lay eyes on the situation and had invited Ramirez with TCEQ to the meeting so that the agency would have situational awareness regarding the well. Quote, "We need a fact-finding investigation into what is going on. I am pleased to see that at the moment the immediate problem is being handled. Obviously, a lot of effort is going into stopping the flow and preventing further damage," Landgraf said. Quote, "At this point, the Railroad Commission has identified the principal operator responsible, and that operator, Chevron, is taking the matter very seriously," he said. "My understanding, after talking with TCEQ, is that once the water stops flowing, their experts can go down the hole, collect data, and find out the cause and whether groundwater has been impacted," he said. After the meeting, Landgraf explained that in situations like this, exactly which agency, TCEQ or Railroad Commission, would have primary jurisdiction was not immediately clear, since both had jurisdiction overseeing some groundwater issues. Quote, "Jurisdiction is determined by the cause of the groundwater issue, and that will be determined during the investigation," he said. Landgraf also noted that while Crane County is not part of his District 81, he felt it was his responsibility as chairman of the House Environmental Regulation Committee to personally investigate, and as further incentive that Crane County abuts Ward County, which is part of his district, and that the issues involved were potentially regional in impact. In an update on Tuesday, Landgraf said, quote, "The experts at TCEQ are investigating and will continue to do their due diligence to determine whether or not ground or drinking water has been impacted. As chairman of the House Environmental Regulation Committee and a resident of the Permian Basin, I will continue to follow this matter closely and will be sure to inform folks if there is any cause for concern when it comes to our water," end quote. At the end of the meeting at the well site, Ramirez told the group that TCEQ would be back on site in the 2 to 3 weeks to look into the matter in more depth. Of note, the Railroad Commission is overseen by a different House committee, the House Energy Resources Committee. Crane County is part of District 82, represented by Tom Craddock, who is a member of the Energy Resources Committee. One dead in wrong-way I-20 crash. Monahan's man in serious condition. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A two-vehicle collision near mile marker 95 on Interstate 20 in Ector County at 2:45 a.m. on Tuesday left one man dead and a Monahan's man in serious condition. Raul Villanueva, age 36, of Monahan's, driving a 2016 Chevrolet Silverado pickup, was traveling east on the westbound lanes when it collided with a 2008 Dodge Nitro SUV driven by Arnaldo Esquivel de la Rosa, age 28, of Denton. De la Rosa was headed west in the westbound lanes. According to a report from the Texas Department of Public Safety, De la Rosa was pronounced dead at the scene by the Ector County Medical Examiner. Villanueva was transported to Medical Center Hospital in Odessa, where his condition was listed as serious. Both men were wearing seatbelts, and there were no passengers. Weather conditions were clear, and the road was dry, according to the DPS. The accident was being investigated by Trooper Brendan Stevens of Odessa with assistance from Troopers Mariana Lopez of Andrews and Joseph LeBlanc and Zachary Rogers of Odessa. No further information was available. Vasquez home, total loss in fire. Fire erupted in a Monahan's home around 10:30 p.m. on Monday on the corner of 14th Street and Fay Avenue. The older home was fully involved by the time Monahan's volunteer fire department arrived on the scene at 10:44 p.m. The home, belonging to Jose Vasquez, was a total loss. Fire Chief Randy Crabtree said, quote, "It appeared the fire started on the south side of the home. There were a lot of items in the yard and in the house that hampered our efforts. Sections of a wood fence had to be cut down to gain access," end quote. The fire was not fully contained until around 1:30 Tuesday morning. Two MVFD pumpers, a brush truck, and a water tanker were all used to help contain the fire. Several dogs were in the house, and five of the six dogs perished, Vasquez said. The fire department was aided by Monahan's Police Department and Ward County Sheriff's Department. Sales tax up from last year, but lower than December. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. January sales tax revenues for Monahan's and all other Ward County communities is higher than January 2021, although most are lower than last month. Monahan's received $293,000 compared to $283,000 last January, an increase of 3.5%. However, receipts last month were slightly higher with $300,000. City Manager Rex Thies said, quote, "The January sales tax allocation for November 2021 collections was up a little over $10,000 from the previous November. However, November was down from the previous month of October by $7,000. On a positive note, if you look at the January allocation year-to-date from January last year, the city is up 3.5%. Hopefully, we will see that percentage remain in the green throughout this year," end quote. Grand Falls received $8,800 in January compared to $3,500, up by 153%, but receipts in December were $20,000. Piote was up 13.9% with total receipts of $10,000 compared to $9,400 last January, but less than December total of $11,000. Thorntonville and Wicked both received more than last January and more than December. Thorntonville received $8,500, 96% higher than last January's total of $4,300. December receipts were $7,300. Wicked received $27,000 in January compared to $19,000 last January, up by 44%. The January total was also higher than December's total of $21,900. Across the area, receipts were mixed. Andrews was up by 32% over last January with $683,000 compared to $517,000. In Reeves County, Pecos received $537,000, up by 16% over last January's total of $462,000. But both Balmoray and Toya were down. Balmoray received $7,600 compared to $9,000, a drop of 15%. Toya dropped by 27% to $1,900 last January. Toya received $2,600. In Winkler County, county receipts and both Kermit and Wink received more than last January. The county was up by 52% with $213,000 compared to $139,000. Kermit received $150,000, 69% over last January's total of $89,000. Wink was up by 20% was $28,400 compared to $23,500 last year. In Pecos County, Fort Stockton received $327,000, down by 3% from last January's total of $340,000. Ira Ann dropped from $40,900 to $24,000, a decline of 41%. In Midland County, the county was up by 80% to $4.6 million compared to $2.5 million last January. City of Midland received $5.5 million compared to $3.7 million for the same period last year, up by 48%. Crane dropped sharply from $103,000 last January to $58,000, a decline of 43%. Monahans, Andrews, Fort Stockton, and Ira Ann all assess a sales tax rate of 2%. Pecos, Crane, Balmoray, and Toya assess 1.5%. The City of Midland assesses 1.25%, and tax rate for Kermit and Wink is 1.0%. County rates for Midland and Winkler counties are 0.5%. These allocations are based on sales made in November by businesses that report tax monthly. Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager sent cities, counties, transit systems, and special purpose taxing districts $992 million in local sales tax allocations for the month of January, which is 26% more than in January of 2021.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.